From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is going to be made on May 1st, 2017, the end of the first 100 days of the presidency of Donald Trump. President-elect Trump is promising that he will have accomplished a great deal in that time span, from executive orders to legislation, a plan for a border wall, and more. And what about his relationship with journalists? Earlier this year, Trump said it was time to loosen libel laws to allow people to sue the news media with more ease and success. In many ways, he wants our system to resemble the UK. It could put some news organizations in danger. Will he follow through on that, and can he? Well, investigative journalist David K. Johnston wrote the book, The Making of Donald Trump. In the book, Johnston details how Trump has made revenge and getting even a core part of his belief system. So by May 1st, how might that manifest? Or perhaps, will we see a more gracious Donald Trump as president? David K. Johnston, welcome back to Connections.
Well, thank you, Evan. You know, since Trump's election, I've been besieged with calls from news reporters all over the world. But you and a producer at MSNBC and one radio station in L.A., the only domestic journalist to get in touch with me. You were the first.
Why do you think that is?
I think that the American news media, after 40 years of attacks and being cowed and with the loss of revenue, has lost its way about doing its job, which is to report facts fully and fairly. And in this election, you know, we got tons about emails, but not one of the five big newspapers, the Associated Press or the three commercial television networks or PBS, said a single word about Donald Trump's, to cite just one example, deep, long engagement with a major cocaine trafficker whom he risked everything he had just to assure him of his loyalty.
So,
not reported anywhere in my book, but and overseas, all over the place, but not in the mainstream press.
And so, David, with Donald Trump saying that the media in many ways has been targeting him unfairly, you think the media has not done nearly enough?
Oh, no. And the problem is Donald Trump falls outside the conventions of what journalists are trained to do. Donald Trump is not a politician who has something to sell. And I'll use Paul Ryan as an example. I've written some very critical opinion columns about Paul Ryan and his policies. But I respect that Paul Ryan honestly and sincerely believes what he's doing, and he thinks it would make the country better. I just think that his math is off and that his views will make things worse. But I approach him on that grounds. That's how the news media has approached Trump. Trump is not a politician. There is no philosophy here. He is about the glorification of the genetically superior. That's his word about himself, not mine, his and his son's. The genetically superior Donald Trump, who doesn't have to study anything because he is so superior as a result of breeding that in 90 minutes he can learn everything you need to know about nuclear missiles, for example. And he's a con artist, and the news media has failed to capture this about Trump, about who he is. And he's also, as we saw with the Billy Bush tape and other matters, he's a 70-year-old man trapped in the psyche of the emotional state of a 13-year-old boy, something I was saying long before that tape came out. He's not mature.
Okay, well, he's going to be the next president.
Absolutely.
He's your president and mine. And David, you made a point off air that I think should be made on air. What we see around the country right now are protests, demonstrations, marches in many major city streets. And there was something that you wanted to stress about these kind of demonstrations, because I suspect we could see more of them going forward.
I suspect we're going to see many more of these going forward. And we might have seen them if Hillary Clinton had won the election. I'm not endorsing here Hillary Clinton, but here's what's important. Under President Obama, Congress expanded the president's authority to suspend the privilege of habeas corpus. You know, people think, oh, I got arrested by the police, I have the right to make a phone call. No, you do not. The Constitution calls it a privilege, and it can be suspended in cases of insurrection and now under this law for other reasons. So Donald Trump, whose philosophy is revenge, he has said that if he has said and written a number of times across time and space, that if he asks you to do a favor and you decline, you have now attacked him, and he will spend the rest of his life trying to make your life miserable, and that he gets pleasure from destroying other lives and making them miserable. If there are acts of violence by demonstrators, it will give him the opportunity to do exactly that, to essentially let his authoritarian impulses run free. And so no matter how much violence is perpetrated by people against others because of the color of their skin, because of their gender, People have to respond totally peacefully, or this could really go bad, and we could end up with what I have been concerned about for a long time, as you know, and that is that if he was president, Donald Trump might well suspend the Constitution and act as a dictator, because he has repeatedly spoken of the job of president as if the president is a dictator.
Well, he has spoken admiringly of Putin because Putin has such great control.
That's
he
exactly
likes
right.
control.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
So, well, your concern is demonstrate, fine, must do it peacefully.
Absolutely. And if people get out of line, separate them, block them, point the police to them, and do not react in kind to people who were, they were going to see acts of violence. You know, we had some young men in a pickup truck driving through Wellesley College, where Hillary Clinton had graduated, mocking the women who go there. The police asked them to leave. It's private property, so that they could. But we're going to see a reaction because Donald Trump has unleashed these forces. And unfortunately, instead of appealing to Americans as the land of the free and the home of the brave, his approach has been be afraid, be fearful, and hate other people. Don't trust other people. That doesn't mean that the people who voted for him don't have legitimate economic grievances. I've spent the last 20 years of my life documenting how the bottom 90% have been badly treated by our economy. But Trump is not going to help those people. My column this week in the Daily Beast is about why the people who voted for Trump are going to rue the day they did so in time, because his policies are not at all oriented towards them. And in fact, while he ran for president, he said, wages are too high, and he said it more than once.
And you wrote recently about wages. Interestingly enough, just at the tail end of the Obama presidency, we see wages rising at just about all levels, but not necessarily in time for people to really feel it or notice it.
That's right.
So with status quo, and we're not going to see status quo in the first 100 days, I mean, I'm sure with a Republican Congress, I'm sure there'll be some dissension, but there will be new legislation. It's not going to be status quo. This will not be an extension of the Obama presidency. But if there were status quo, I guess what I'm asking is Donald Trump in position to take advantage of what is already a trend upward in terms of wages and economic bounce back?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Donald is a very smart guy, and he looks for openings and opportunities to get what he wants. And he's going to claim credit for rising wages, even though this has been baked in now for a while. One of the smart things he's proposing, if he does it, is a massive infrastructure program that would result in numerous hirings, lots of people being put to work who are either unskilled or semi-skilled. The problem he's going to have is the Republicans in Congress. They won't raise taxes, and they hate deficit spending, and he's argued against deficit spending. Under President Obama, the deficit has plummeted. It's come way down from $1.4 trillion when he came into office at the low point down to about $250 billion. And because of government accounting, it's really not a deficit at that point because the government buys long-lasting assets. It just doesn't account for them the way business does. But Trump's going to claim credit for that. And if he, in fact, gets some kind of big infrastructure program through, that will be good for some people who have been the losers in the rules of the last 35 years, and he will claim benefit from that. I'm less worried about those things than about international matters, the kind of secrets a president has to hold, the kind of public lashing a president has to take for things where he knows he's doing the right thing, but he can't speak out about it. And that's true of every president. And I don't think Donald has the emotional stability and maturity to deal with those things well.
There will be a terrorist attack at some point. And I'm not trying to be macabre here. I mean, what I'm saying is I'm not talking about necessarily even a 9/11 style attack. I mean, though, who knows in today's world? I'm talking even San Bernardino and other style. And what you want is a cool hand, stability, smart people around them. And what you seem to be saying is that's your biggest concern in a Trump presidency, are those moments of real sort of a flashpoint, a possible reaction?
And not just domestically. I mean, look, we have always had terrorism. You can find acts of terrorism in the Old Testament. Terrorism is the action of people who are powerless militarily to get what they want or change their circumstances. I'm more concerned on the international level. I mean, all around the world, if you, as I did yesterday and today, look at foreign news reports and what governments around the world are saying, they are very alarmed about this. They are deeply troubled and very concerned that Donald Trump, who's spoken loosely about nuclear weapons, who's asked, why don't we use them? Who's suggested that we should not defend NATO against an incursion by Putin if they don't pay more into the costs of running NATO? Which, by the way, advances the principal foreign policy aim of that murderous autocrat who wants to rebuild the old Soviet empire. He has claimed at various things at various times. He's not consistent, but, you know, was not Putin's army that invaded Crimea and parts of the Ukraine, which is absolute nonsense. And, of course, we know that all 17 federal intelligence agencies say the evidence is overwhelming that the hack of the DNC emails was by Putin. Trump didn't denounce Putin for that. He didn't say that's inappropriate. During the campaign, he called on Putin and his government to hack U.S. government emails.
He later said he was kidding.
Well, you know what? He was asked. Let me tell you what's very important about this in the news. He wasn't kidding. Katie Tour of MSNBC asked a follow-up question, and Trump stuck by it. And she said again, are you serious? Are you really? And he said, of course I'm serious. He was dead serious. Then when he got all the criticism, he came back the next day. This is a standard Trump tactic. You say what you want to the audience you want to have, and then later you say, oh, I didn't mean that, or it was sarcastic, even though nothing in his tone was sarcastic. And it's part of the reason that Americans need to develop in a hurry a much more sophisticated understanding of politics, of the exercise of power, and of who Donald Trump is.
Talking to David K. Johnston, an investigative journalist who wrote the book, The Making of Donald Trump. If you want to call the program with comments or questions, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Before we go to our listeners, I've just got two more for you. On the subject of libel law, I want to listen to something that Chris Thomas said, who was a partner with Nixon Peabody when we talked this past April. This past April, during the primary season, Donald Trump came out and said that he wanted looser libel law, that he was tired of news media articles about him that were not praising, that were not fawning, and that he thought it's too hard to sue the news in this country, even though he's tried to do that. He's tried to do that with authors. He has boasted that he knew he couldn't win, but he wanted to financially injure people.
So, that's correct.
So he has this mindset that he wants it to be easier to do that. And what Chris Thomas said was two things. He said, first of all, the good news in our country is that it'd be very difficult even for a president to try to unilaterally change libel law. But it doesn't mean that he wouldn't try. And here's something else Chris Thomas said about that.
The idea that we would go back to that, or that there would even be the risk of going back to that, from my perspective, is disturbing and, frankly, deeply un-American at this point.
That's what Chris says about this desire to go back to a system where you can almost with impunity just sue journalists, put them out of business.
The First Amendment in this country, which protects lots of rights, not just the rights of the press, rights of speech, right of assembly, right to believe or not believe, and to practice your religion, was adopted at a time when the newspapers of the day routinely just made things up. We had party press, and presidents had things made up about them, senators, governors. And even though everyone knew that there were all sorts of just flat-out lies being printed, they felt freedom of speech and the press was more important than their personal attitudes. That's because they were mature, well-educated people. They weren't Donald Trump, who believes only in the glorification and the greatness of Donald Trump, and who has been very clear, if it's not favorable to me, if I don't like it. He called me in April at home and told me that he would sue me if I didn't write it the way he likes. I've been a reporter now this month for 50 years. From the Santa Cruz, California City Council to the White House, I've never had a politician come within a mile of a statement like that. Because Trump's not a politician. He's a con artist.
Okay, but David, are you now concerned with your book out there and him about to become president? Do you feel that you could be sued, that you could be targeted? And do you think he really will try to move forward and limit press coverage that's negative?
Donald Trump will now have the power and ability to make my life difficult. Because of this law that was passed during Obama's time, he could literally have federal agents sweep me out of my house and hold me without any opportunity to have a hearing before a judge. And he may not, but I am going to do what it's my duty to do. You don't run away from your job. You know, if you're a police officer and there's a shootout, you don't go, oh, I might get killed. You go to where the action is. I've run into a burning building. I have taken on the governments of South Africa and Taiwan. I have taken on, as somebody wrote about me once, Johnston is a big game hunter who takes on the biggest and most powerful institutions and people in the world. And that's a reasonable description. So, no, I'm going to do what I need to do.
All right. Well, when it comes to that kind of power, when it comes to that effort to have more of a unilateral power, what we've seen under the Obama administration is, I think, a president frustrated with an obstreperousness from Mitch McConnell, from Congress. We heard that from the opening days of his administration in 2009. And in some ways, he conducted an end around. He used executive orders. He got some things done. They criticized him for expanding his power. Here is where, in my observation, I wonder if you can expand on this, David. Democrats may rue this, having a president, even if they think Obama used that executive power appropriately and thoughtfully. The fact that you set a bit of a paradigm here means that the next president, right, who may not be of your party, may not use it in the way you like. And now Donald Trump is coming into an office, and it has been established that the president has more power than I think the framers wanted.
Absolutely. You know, my favorite Twitter hashtag is facts matter, and my second favorite one is integrity matters. The institutions matter. You can like or dislike Donald Trump, but we need to have peaceful transition because it is the republic that matters, not the old holder of the office at the moment. And I want to notice something that's very different going on here. On the very night of Barack Obama's inaugural balls in 2009, Mitch McConnell and 13 other prominent Republicans held a meeting. They've all talked about it since then, and they vowed they were going to make him fail as a president. Not what happened when George Bush got elected. The Democrats said, you got elected, and they gave him his tax cut and some other things that he wanted. That didn't mean they rolled over, but they said, you know, you won, and you're entitled to this. Hillary Clinton said, he is our president, support our president. That's totally different than how the Republicans treated Obama. And it's unfortunate that Obama has done some of the things he has, because in the hands of a ignorant demagogue like Donald Trump, they could be a real danger to the republic.
All right. And the last point I want to make before we go over to your phone calls is this. David writes in his piece for the Daily Beast this week, quote, "The significance of Trump's election is in the disaffection of people the Democrats historically courted, millions of whom chose Trump," end quote. Jim Newell, writing for Slate Magazine Online in a piece titled this morning, "The Democratic Establishment is Finished, What a Joke." Here's what Jim writes about just how dire the situation is for Democrats right now. Quote, "Think of how wrong the entire national media conversation was about how the Republicans were being torn apart as a party. I pre-wrote a piece Tuesday afternoon to be published in the event of the expected Clinton win, pushing back against both myself and other members of the media, arguing that Democrats and Republicans were both in existential trouble, and that in the short-term context of a decaying political system, Republicans might even have the edge. Democrats could win the presidency most of the time, but never a majority of state governments or the House, while Republicans could always win the majority of state governments and the House, and occasionally, probably in 2020, I thought, the White House. Well, this was wrong. Republicans don't have a slight edge over Democrats in a decaying political system. Republicans are ascendant. Trump has given them their mission. The country is now theirs," end quote. What do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And if the Republicans handle this in a smart way, we will move in the direction of being an authoritarian, business-oriented society where your liberties and your consumer protections will decline, and we'll have a harsh criminal justice system. And if Mike Pence has his way, a woman who is near delivery, who's faced with the prospect of either she dies or fetus dies, and maybe she's a mother of five or six children, he would have the mother die. I mean, we'll see what happens here and how they play their cards. But I don't believe Trump personally is so much the issue here. There are others poised to come along behind him whose appeal is not to our better natures. And we also have to develop, a deeper understanding of these issues about economics, because there's no question that what I've denigrated for years in a deliberate reference to light beer, you know, this watery nonsense, Democrat light. That's what the Clintons were, Democrat light, when it came to economics, not to individual liberties, but to economics. And they made their peace with Wall Street, and people have become revulsed by this, and they have turned to someone who said, I will save you. He won't. he's antithetical to their interests. But if you, as I wrote in the column, quoting from the movie The American President, when people, if they don't have leadership, will go to a mirage, and when they get there, if they have to, they'll drink sand. Well, they just drank sand.
And I lied. Last question before our listeners. On that subject of executive power, you just brought up Mike Pence, his views on abortion. He has said in this campaign that Roe v. Wade will be consigned to the dustbin of history. We'll see. Certainly the Supreme Court's going to be made in a conservative image. And those who oppose abortion are thrilled with this idea that this could happen, that it could certainly happen in the next 4 years. Let me ask, David, today the White House put out a sign, a signal that President Obama is going to try to permanently protect funding for Planned Parenthood through, again, another one of these kinds of mechanisms that, right. that he is going to try to put it in place that for political reasons you cannot defund Planned Parenthood. I don't know how successful that would be, and there's a lot of technical questions about how those things could be undone in the next administration. Is this an example of a president who understands that Roe v. Wade is in jeopardy and Planned Parenthood is in jeopardy, making the right decision? Or again, is this a unilateral action that, while well-intended, is not the right thing to do?
I don't think that it's a smart approach to deal with this problem. I respect people who have a well-thought-through position against abortion. I've also twice in my life had to literally make the decision I talked about. Am I going to have the mother of my children die or my wife? And because in both cases my wife was under anesthesia, the decision was mine to make. And nobody, in the way Donald Trump talked about casually how he talks about this, and Mike Pence does, like people are just, oh, happy, oh, let's do this or that. Boy, that is like the most difficult decision. And I had to do this the first time when I was in my mid-20s. And it is a terribly difficult thing to address. And by the way, my children, who are all grown, know all about this and have both said that I made exactly the right choice in both cases, which was we're going to save the mother if things go badly. Luckily, they did not. And I've never talked about this before, but I think people need to come out and talk about these issues because, frankly, I don't think it's the federal government's business. It's not the government's business.
But David, in terms of policy then, you want more people to discuss it, in realistic terms, but you don't necessarily want to see President Obama try to entrench permanently funding for Planned Parenthood.
No, I think that that's just, I understand the political instinct to do that, but I think that we need to deal with these issues through popular will and better education of people about it and outing demagogues on this issue. Now, a lot of people have demagogued this issue. So I see we got a whole bunch of callers.
Okay, all right. So, and listeners, by the way, we are going to talk to Planned Parenthood. We will talk to those who oppose abortion. We'll have an entire discussion on that next week because that really is become a front burner topic. We're going to get our only break of the hour and we come right back to your phone calls for investigative journalist David K. Johnston. Your phone calls, tweets, and emails next. Coming up in our second hour, the Finger Lakes Land Trust has priorities, including dealing with toxic algae in the lakes and also sprawl in the region. Begs the question, what is the right kind of development in the Finger Lakes region? Well, we'll talk about that with a number of stakeholders, get their thoughts, including their thoughts on whether environmental funding and some sources of funding will change under a new administration. It's all coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to start with Stephen in Rochester with David K. Johnston. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yes. What I'd like to make a mention of what concerns me about Donald Trump and his economic policies. I'm really worried about one thing. First of all, I heard him making a political campaign rally speech where he said he wants to put a 35% tariff on Chinese imports. And then I also heard on a news report adding to that Mexico also. And the idea of, in combination with that, he's also mentioned how he wants to get rid of the health care system the way it is now, which was one of the major parts of our economic recovery that has occurred since 2008. Taking a wrecking ball to that, God knows what's going to happen. But even more concerning to me is this 35% tariff, because
sure.
I look at it this way. I see when I go to a store, and I used to do inventory work, and I looked at the labels on stuff. So much stuff is made in China, and even Mexico, too, nowadays, that is coming into this country, you have no other choice but to buy that stuff. So isn't this really like a 35% tax on consumption if he does something like that? Hopefully, yep. This guy is only saying things like that, but when he gets in office, he will not do things like this because I don't see any other choice. I mean, when people go to the store and they have no other choice, there's nothing made in America, and they need something, and it's 35% more. I think this is all going to cause all kinds of economic malaise. And
Stephen, let me jump in and let David go ahead. Yeah.
Well, first of all, Congress controls tariffs, not the president. And it's inconceivable to me that the Republicans are going to be in control would go with a 35% tariff. They are globalists.
That's a trade war.
War, and it would be a disaster. Trump gave these exaggerated numbers, $800 billion trade loss. Our sale of services to the rest of the world is going like crazy. The rules that we've had have not so much been the problem as the failure of Congress to mitigate the losses. When you have trade, some people win and some lose. And we've allowed the globalists to win, the world-level capitalists to win, the rural poor of China to win, but we haven't done hardly anything for all the factory workers and others who've lost out. So I would worry not so much about that. On the healthcare front, just as Nixon went to China, maybe Donald will go back to his historic idea that healthcare should be free and universal. That's what he used to argue before he ran as president. He and I have actually talked about this long years ago. And just to give you an idea of how important it would be, if we could get the healthcare system of France, the best in the world, or Germany, pretty close to the best, both of which are universal with no out-of-pocket costs in France and only a little, very little in Germany, it would save an amount of money equal to eliminating the income tax for 99% of Americans.
All right.
99.3% last year.
Do you suspect that, as he said, he's going to, number one, TPP out, he'll either renegotiate tariff, NAFTA, any other trade agreements? He essentially said in the trail he doesn't like any of the trade agreements.
Right. He doesn't know what's in them either. He has no idea what's in them. I mean, I know this, some people are going to blanch when I say this, but Donald Trump doesn't know anything. And if you read The Making of Donald Trump, you see where he's asked questions under oath. He gives answers that are gibberish. It's all a con. It's just like when he said, no one reads the Bible more than Donald Trump. And his answer went, well, what's your favorite passage or what are some passages you like? Oh, there's so many. And then he goes on. He doesn't know anything and he doesn't understand these trade agreements. I tried to explain to Donald in 1990 at lunch how he could handle his taxes a little differently and be better off. It was like seven steps. He couldn't follow it. There are only two things that get Donald Trump's undivided attention: a woman he desires unbuttoning her blouse, or someone saying, I got a deal for you with $1 million check up front and you don't have to do anything but sign your name.
Okay, but when it comes to trade deals, though, you think the Republicans will block his effort to create a trade war?
Yes, I think they're going to want to renegotiate some of these deals, and I think that makes good sense. I mean, there's no reason not to adjust rules. We should never operate in the assumption that the status quo is how things should be.
Okay. Back to your phone calls. Kate in Irondequoit is next. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi. I just want to go back to your intro and talk a little bit about the first 100 days,
mm-hmm.
Specifically a piece of information that came out of a document called Trump's contract to the American voter, specifically that for every federal regulation that is created, two more regulations would have to be not in use anymore.
Eliminated, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I guess I'm just curious about your all's
what
that is.
Kate, that is the definition of moronic. And anybody who thinks that, you know, that is a way to approach anything makes no sense whatsoever. We have enormous number of regulations. I teach regulation at Syracuse Law, the history and the development of them. Most of the regulations, however, are written by business for business. Many of them are designed to protect a business position against competitors, to reduce the rights of consumers. It is business that generates most of these rules. But the idea that we're going to do two for one, that is moronic.
Well, but David, if many of the regulations are sort of anti-competitive, game the system, then why isn't it a good thing to have a two for one trade?
Because this is not an off trade. You want to get rid of those regulations that impede commerce, that throw sand in the gears of commerce, that deny people justice, because civilization is justice. That is the definition of civilization, is some kind of justice. And So you want to do this in a smart way. That means you have to go through and say, defend this regulation, explain why it's here. And the quickest way Congress could do that is that no changes will be made in federal law without a hearing and without those senators and congressmen who sponsored it having their name attached to it clause by clause.
Roy in Rochester, next up with David K. Johnston. Go ahead, Roy.
Good morning.
Hi there. Go ahead.
It's a different world. I think I'm looking back on things. When I was 5 years old, my next door neighbors were New Dealers, and they introduced me to their friend Eleanor Roosevelt. I've always had a fondness for, I guess, that part of the world. And then I won't remember this election as Donald Trump. I'll remember it as standing in Mount Hope Cemetery in the rain for 3 hours to go to Susan B.'s grave. Otherwise, I think that it's a European experience for me, something I used to read about with Russian writers and intellectuals. You have one face for the day-to-day world, and you have an inner migration of the soul.
Well, Roy, I appreciate the phone call, and certainly I think we've heard from those who've at least felt that communing with Susan B. and that scene, and you know, you've seen a lot in your career. What did you make of that scene, David Kay?
I thought it was absolutely terrific, and people also went to the gravestone of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, like me, a parent of eight, in New York City, and a woman who's the leader of the neighborhood organization there, I wrote a piece about it for National Memo, said something I thought was very important. No matter how this election turns out, we should pay homage to those who made it possible for women to have the vote. There were two groups that did that. The suffragettes who fought for 80 years to do it, or 70-some years, and the male politicians who cast the votes.
Alan writes an email and wants to know your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, and I will lead in with this here, David, with the Republicans controlling the White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives, we're certainly going to see some kind of change. And I feel like there's two options here. Tell me if I'm wrong. I feel like they will either, we know what they're going to do in terms of they will say that they're going to take it apart. They will have to declare a political victory that this is the end of, they will say this is the end of quote-unquote Obamacare.
Absolutely.
So we know that that will happen. And either they will really just kind of take it apart and start with something entirely different, or they will maybe remove a mandate. They will keep certain elements that are cores of it. They will add other elements to it. They will call it something else. Maybe they'll call it Trump care. Maybe they'll call it GOP care. But they will claim victory but keep the core elements. What do you think?
I would be very surprised. Donald Trump was very clear. We're going to tear out every aspect of this. And the pressure that should be brought on the Republicans about this is, what about people who have pre-existing conditions? The insurance companies have no interest in representing them. And let's remember, the reason that we have the Affordable Care Act is a compromise where the insurance companies rented members of Congress to get what they wanted. There is no reason to have insurance companies. They are a totally superfluous and unnecessary industry that adds costs. And as I wrote in one of my earlier books and documented from congressional records, literally bonuses doctors who kill people by denying them care. And a doctor who testified under oath, you know, I got rich being paid to deny care to people and therefore save money. The guy who started one of the first HMOs and converted it, whom I did exposés of 30 years ago, Bob Gumbiner, before he died, said, I never should have been allowed to do this. The whole insurance thing is wrong. But we should have universal national health care, but he felt he shouldn't be blamed for taking advantage of it and building up a fortune of $2 billion from the taxpayers. But no, I think you're going to see repeal of it. I don't think there's going to be any significant replacement of it. So.
Okay. John and Henrietta next. Go ahead, John.
I wanted to ask a question about Donald Trump's health, because he didn't really release accurate records, full records, and he is apparently technically overweight, and they covered that by giving him another inch. Somehow he grew up to 6'3". That was covered by PBS. What happens if this man gets sick or dies? We're going to have a President Pence.
Right.
And I almost think he's going to be worse.
Yeah, I said earlier in the show, John, that I don't think having President Pence would be any better. We don't know Donald's actual health records, and his adding this inch is typical of how Donald does things. You know, he overstates his wealth. He says that Trump Tower is 68 stories. It's actually 58. That's just part of his making things up.
He's asking if they're... if we should be concerned about his health. I see no reason outwardly to be concerned about his health, but he is right in that we don't really have accurate records.
We don't. His father and mother both lived to be, I think his father was 93 when he died.
Okay. So good family history of longevity.
I think there's a good question about should we be electing people my age, 67 or older, to the White House. But, the country is built to endure as long as we don't have a suspension of our Constitution.
By the way, before I get back to phone calls, on the ACA, on Alan's question, if you're correct, David, and we really see it taken apart by Republicans and the Trump White House, what goes in its place? What do you think healthcare will look like?
I think that we will go back to having large numbers of people who don't have healthcare, who show up in emergency rooms, who die prematurely. I mean, I know three women who died from breast cancer because they had no healthcare, and emergency rooms only patch you up. They're not obligated to do chronic long-term care. We unnecessarily create widows, widowers, and orphans in this country because of our health care policy and also make people disabled because they don't get proper health care. It's cheaper to do it. Every other modern country has recognized what Trump used to say. It should be a right and you just get health care. I tell my students at Syracuse, tell me about the experiences you're having being pitched by kindergarten salesmen. I mean, you must be getting pitches left and right for kindergarten insurance. You all are being told you better buy kindergarten insurance now, get it while it's cheap in the future. And they look at me and I go, I'm sorry, you're college students. I assume you engage in activities that have been known to cause a need for kindergarten. Oh, that's right. You don't have to buy kindergarten insurance because we provide it as a public service. That's how Donald used to say we should do healthcare. It's actually where I got the idea from kindergarten insurance was from something Donald said to me years ago.
Used to, though. So,
used to.
So we'll see. Tom in Greece, next up with David K. Johnston.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. I did tune in this late, but I was told you hadn't discussed this topic. Okay. Hillary, according to the figures coming in for the election returns that have been coming in this week, Hillary Clinton won barely by, I think, about maybe under a million votes. She won the popular vote. And, okay, that is a terrible indictment of our electoral system. And I would like to be involved in a movement to add to amend the Constitution to abolish the Electoral College system.
Well, I think it'd be a good idea to have a big debate about this.
Tom, I'm sorry.
Tom
in Greece.
I'm sorry. I wrote down the wrong name here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that we need to recognize something. There are 18 provisions that were put in the original Constitution to protect slavery, and this was one of them. This was to make sure that the non-slave states with the bigger populations wouldn't overrun the slave states.
The three-fifths rule.
That's part of it. James F. Wilson, who as a sitting Supreme Court justice was actually arrested and put briefly in behind bars, was the one who put that forth as a compromise. There are 18 provisions, according to Professor Finkelstein at Albany Law, that are designed to protect slavery. And I do think we should discuss whether it's antiquated.
Because, it's a relic, yes.
Yeah, whether it's a relic. And Al Gore also won the popular vote. But, we've had this happen twice, two other times.
Well,
this
time is the fifth time, actually.
What do you think is going to happen with this?
I don't think it'll go anywhere. I think that there are much more sort of pressing issues about it. And I think if the Democrats want to be dominant, they've got to do a lot of work getting out and dealing with attracting people by showing they'll do a better job for them. And that's what politics is about. Aristotle said that ethics are to make us individually better. Politics, the goal of it is not power. The goal of politics should be to make society good.
Deb writes to us and wants to know if, based on David's research, Deb wants to know, do you think we could see a more measured man in his governing than his campaigning? Was he gaming a la Survivor to forge alliances with groups just in order to win?
Well, Donald was doing whatever he thought it would take to win, and obviously he did it very, very well and very brilliantly. But I don't think he's going to change, and he doesn't have a depth. Donald doesn't understand the Constitution. He doesn't understand how government works. I mean, you know, he's not a CEO who had a board of directors. He's the absolute ruler of his empire. That's why he always talks in these dictatorial terms. And the only time he ever had to relate to people was when he got in trouble with his bankers back in 1990. And let's not forget that one of his surrogates, Ms. Amoroso, said a couple of days ago that Donald has a list he's keeping of those who did not, this is her words, bow down to him. We don't bow to our presidents.
So Deb's follow-up then is, given some of your predictions about what's to come with him, is there a kind of a system to prepare legal responses to what may be coming?
Oh, I suspect that a whole bunch of groups, Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, others are busy with lawyers figuring out steps they need to do, things they need to have to be ready to go with about Trump's behavior. And I suspect many of the Republicans in Congress, let's remember the Republican Party is not unified here. It's in disarray. Every living former president publicly announced he was not voting for Donald Trump. Many leading Republicans said this man is not fit. My phrase is manifestly unfit, but they said he wasn't fit and they weren't going to vote for him. There's still a huge break going on here. As one of my grown children who lives here in Rochester, Amy, you know, likes to say, and she's a registered Republican, you have to remember that Republicans and the Republican Party are two different things. And I think we just saw that in this election, which marks the end of the age of Reagan.
Before I go to our next caller, who tends to identify himself as a liberal but is often frustrated with the Democratic Party, I want to ask you what you think of Nick Kristof writing in the New York Times today that Democrats have to refrain from constantly describing Trump voters as bigots.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, first of all, there are many bigots among Trump voters, but that's not all of them. And I have for a long time been saying in various forums, stop dissing everyone who is, if you're a liberal or progressive, who's a believer. Yes, there are fake Christians who preach riches only, but there are many honest believers, and you should respect people no matter what their faith is. Stop talking to people who are not educated. And I think this is a real problem for the Democrats. The Democrats have become too oriented towards well-educated people like me, people who have college educations and who live in their heads. And it was one of Hillary Clinton's problems. I mean, here's a woman who carries a Bible in her purse and reads it all the time and who has a deep faith. Well, Trump said it's all fake. It's not. She's genuinely, I've never met her, but many people who have tell me she is a genuinely very lovely person. And she, we should not tolerate from anybody in America. We should call out people who engage in the subtle bigotry of, you know, you're stupid, you're ill-informed. No.
It buried Democrats in this election, you think?
It sure did, and it's kind of bizarre because it's the Republicans' open bigotry that got them where they are. But that doesn't make everybody who supported Donald Trump a bigot.
All right, let me go to Tim in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. David, you're my favorite guest, and I agree with you completely, being a liberal. And I've got to catch myself on it time and again, talking down to people. It's just ridiculous, and it gets us in trouble, and there's really no reason for it at all. But one question and one comment. Universal health care, which I'm a fan of, as someone who's in the supposed middle class and a healthy individual, does it work out for my family, or is it going to be far more expensive? And two, the comment is it amazes me that Republicans want the government to stay out of our business until it comes to abortion, and then they want the government right in there handling everything and telling people no. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah. Well, if universal health care should probably be financed through a regressive tax. That's what the Nordic countries do. They do it through a sales tax. And the reason is very simple. Bill Gates' lifetime health care costs are not going to be much different than yours or mine, Tim. And so the sensible way to do it is to look upon it as a mass purchasing issue for everybody and recognize there are outliers. There are going to be babies born who will run up $1 million health care bills the first day, and there'll be people like my former editor, Ed Guthman, who literally literally was never sick until in his 90th year he got sick. And I sat and talked to him. He said, I've never had this experience. I've never had a cold, never had a flu, and it's very strange to feel this way. Those are both outliers, and it's just a cost. Yeah. If you spread it across everybody, it's not expensive. But, you know, if we ran healthcare the way if we ran kindergarten the way we ran healthcare, at the end of the day, the kindergarten teachers would fill out a report. Today, I gave the girls 6 green crayons, but the boys only had 3 green crayons. And the reason for this is it's just make work.
Paul writes to the program and wants to know, does David K. think we will finally get to see Donald's tax returns?
Not a chance. Never going to happen.
No. Never.
No, and despite the fact that there are badges of fraud in his 1984 return, which is in the making of Donald Trump, despite the fact that he's admitted to sales tax fraud, despite the fact that I have explained to people in plain English how his big tax device that will allow him to live, by my estimate, tax-free until he's 92 years old, several law professors have said that they don't believe it would stand up were he taken to court, that it's illegal. It is a no. We're never going to see his tax returns. I have written a column where I have put the statutory language into the column. Congress, with one line, could require that if you run on the ballot as president in 10 states, I think that's enough.
Yep.
That the IRS would release all of the tax information it has about you. Just remove your name and your Social Security number, the normal things that we redact. And I think we should do that. I absolutely think that we do not want to have. We had an admitted tax crook one heartbeat away from the presidency in Spiro Agnew, and we had a tax crook in the White House, Richard Nixon, who wasn't indicted out of respect for the office of president, but his tax guy went to prison.
All right, so real quick, moving quickly here, Emma writes an email, wants to know if David thinks Trump University as an ongoing lawsuit could impact his presidency.
He's going to ask the courts to delay this until he leaves office. I don't know what Judge Curiel will do, but I hope that in both of these cases, if he gets a deferral, that he's required to post a bond so that he can't later say, oh, I don't have any money. I can't pay. He should have to post a bond.
Okay. But do you think it will be successful?
I don't know.
I just don't know.
Hard to tell. Yeah.
Okay. Bonnie in Rochester. Got to keep it moving. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah. Hi. Two things. One is I'm hoping that people, reacting to the concern about Trump, we'll see the need to take, the major issues that we've been talking about and to increase the organizing around them in a preparatory way so that if and when Trump starts to, address one in a negative way or another, that people can come together quickly and pretty radically. I'm not saying people should have guns or anything like that, but I think this kind of thing only responds to really very direct radical intervention. Second thing is in the issue that people are just talking about how to relate to folks who are, more in the category, for lack of a better way of saying it, to Trump supporters. One of the things you have to be careful about, though, is, and I see the media doing this, unfortunately, a lot, there's a tendency when people either say something, like Hillary Clinton's a witch or some really outrageous thing, or when they even say things that aren't so outrageous, but legitimately problematic. It's better to be honest with people and say, well, listen, I don't understand why you're saying that, and here's what my understanding of it is. And doing some, I would say, kind of more gentle but confrontation over the truth.
All right. I've got to let David jump in. We're running out of time.
Bonnie, listen, cajoling people is much better than attacking people, and we need to do a lot of cajoling. And, yes, I think that people do need to develop affinity groups for be peacefully prepared if things go badly. Maybe the things I'm worried about won't happen. But if Donald Trump moves to suspend the Constitution, if he starts firing generals, that would be the first sign, I would say, of that. I think people need to be prepared for that. And if it doesn't happen, you were just prepared and it wasn't necessary.
Last 40 seconds. Next week, we're going to have a panel of small business owners on who are pro-Trump. Trump won them by more than 2-1,
yep.
Small business owners. They're optimistic. What would you say to small business owners who think this is a very good thing for the country?
Well, I would say to them, if you could get health care off your backs, you would be much better off. You wouldn't divert money or resources to this. You could focus on running your business. When I co-founded a business that has 25 workers, that was the number one thing that struck me was, why am I spending time dealing with health insurance and the health condition of my workers when I want to run the business?
Okay. Well, I hope you'll come back on occasion. This has been a historic week to say the least. And David K. Johnston is the author of The Making of Donald Trump. Another book in store now, David? What's going on?
We haven't settled on what we're going to do, but you will absolutely, there'll be another book here about Trump, and then I'll get to my tax book.
You are not retiring into the sunset with the Trump presidency.
No.
And you can read David's work. He has a column in the Daily Beast this week. Where else, David?
Mostly I'm going to be doing the Daily Beast. I mean, there's some other people I write for. I'll have a piece this Sunday in the Daily Mail in London.
Okay. David KJ on Twitter. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More connections next.